are you right now? Are you sitting? Chances are you may be in some sort of chair. We spend about three quarters of our day in a seated position. We're asking, how did chairs get here and how do they inform where we are as a society? It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Chairs go way, way back, thousands of years, through classical times to the time of pharaohs. You can trace chair to the Latin word cathedra. Let's bring in Vibar Cregan-Reed, who's been writing about chairs. He is a reader in English and environmental humanities in the School of English at the University of Kent. His most recent book is Primate Change, How the World We Made is Remaking Us. And he wrote a piece in The Conversation called Anthropocene, Why the Chair Should Be the Symbol for Our Sedentary Age. Vibar, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning to you.
Well, first of all, help us out with the word Anthropocene. I understand it's when the human started making an imprint on our world.
That's exactly correct. As to when exactly that was, we're not exactly clearly decided on that yet. But yes, it's the name for it's the proposed name for a new geological era. We were for about the last 11,700 years. In an era called the Holocene. But yeah, it looks like it's about to be declared. Our era is about to be declared the Anthropocene.
So why should chairs be the symbol for this age?
Well, that's so interesting. It's like pointing out water to a fish. They're everywhere. And we don't even see them. They seem very normal to us. They seem very natural. I live in an apartment, a not very big apartment in London. There's only two of us, and you know, a quick count of the chairs in our apartment yielded us a result of 22. So there are billions more chairs than there are people on the planet, and most of our work as a species is now done in a chair. So we've only really started using them very recently.
Very recently, what do you mean by that? Because chairs and what seems to be chairs go way, way back in time, you know, thousands of years ago.
Yeah, thousands of years, probably about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. They were probably invented around the same time as the wheel. But the thing is that most of the, so our environments, the places where we live and work and rest, our environments, they invite certain kinds of work, certain kinds of labor for the human body. And the environment for many years was one that invited a very active form of work that required us to mostly be on our feet, to mostly be doing physical kinds of labor. But then with the Industrial Revolution about 200 years ago, that there's a proliferation of sedentary work. So in London in the 1840s, there are only about perhaps about 5,000 or 6,000 people doing administrative work. It was about 0.01 of the population. And then in the US today, it's about 85% of the population use a chair to get their work done. So chairs have suddenly spawned like angry bacteria over the planet.
I love it. Vibar Cregan-Reed is with us. He's a reader in English and environmental humanities in the School of English at the University of Kent. We're talking about the origin of chairs and what they say about us today. Your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. How do you think chairs have changed our lives? How has our more sedentary lifestyle changed the way we live our lives? And do you make an effort to be less sedentary? How do you do that? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Vibar, how did chairs become a status symbol? And are they still a status symbol?
They became, very much so. I think they're still a status symbol. They became a status symbol many years ago. When we began to gather in small settlements, we humans as a species, mostly they all did similar kinds of work. But once we start gathering in things that would now resemble towns or even early cities about 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, you start to get a really big differential between people at the bottom of the pile and people at the top of the pile. So people at the bottom of the pile would have been slaves, usually captured in war, and they would be doing the hardest and most unpleasant physical manual labour. And the people at the top of the pile had leisure time. Their subsistence work was done for them by other people. And so chairs became associated with sedentary leisure. And, you know, most of our lives, most of the things that we do in our lives now, we watch TV, we go to the cinema, we watch plays at the theatre, and we enjoy these things. We enjoy our leisure in a chair. So because chairs were associated with people that didn't have to do manual work, for thousands of years, there weren't very many people that had or needed or even could use a chair if they wanted to. So, for example, the way that status, so it's only very, very important people that had or used chairs for thousands of years. But the way that status still works is in our language, you know, so if you in your office, the boss always has the best chair. The highest attainment in my own profession, which is academia, that's also called a chair. The person that runs a company is a chairperson. So they are still associated with status, but with the mass democratization that took place at the beginning of the 19th century, all of a sudden everybody wanted chairs and they start appearing everywhere in literature, for example.
And even certain types of chairs, what you do in a chair, like a reading chair, for instance, you read in a particular type of chair.
Yeah, well, there was no need to have reading chairs really until the 19th century because so few people could. So these sedentary leisure activities, they only become popular and widespread once machines start to do a great deal of our work for us. And that's the Industrial Revolution.
And when you think about the office as well, people covet their chairs like they covet their staplers. I mean, they take their chairs if they have to move to a different space. And there's something about their own chair, is it not?
Yeah, there is. And I think we believe that our chairs do certain things for us, that we have certain biomechanical issues that will be solved by the right chair or exacerbated by the wrong chair. So, yeah, we become attached to our chairs. They're such an important part of our lives. We spend at least, 60% of our time in them. We spend more time in our chairs than we do sleeping in our beds.
I think the most signature image, for me at least, of a chair in 2018 was watching Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, testify before Congress, and he was sitting in a chair that had a cushion on it because it was a very hard chair there in Congress, and he had a cushion that both elevated him and made the chair less uncomfortable. Yeah. And I still see that image in my head because someone took a picture of that. there's a lot going on in that image, is there not?
There is. There's all sorts of things going on in that image. Comfortable chairs are going to be, they're going to be the death of us, I think. So one of the things, one of the things that I've talked about in my book, Primate Change, is the idea that as chairs become more and more comfortable, as they become more cushioned and more and optimized for human comfort, we inevitably spend more time in them. And what we should really be doing, what we really need in our office, is uncomfortable chairs. Chairs where we can only sit down for about 20 minutes and then we think, oh, I need to get up.
We're talking with Vibar Cregan-Reed, who stays with us, author of Primate Change, How the World We Made is Remaking Us. Your thoughts on chairs, 800-642-1234. Are you aware of the chairs in your life? Do you have a chair for a particular thing you do? 800-642-1234. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kedar Cherkent. There could be more than 60 billion chairs in our world. Vibar Cregan-Reed, our guest, thinks he did some back-of-the-envelope calculation there, thinks it would be hard to go lower than 8 to 10 chairs per person. We're talking about the role of chairs in life and how they've adapted us and we've changed them. Baibar Cregan-Reid takes notes on all of these things as he writes about the chair. He's a reader in English and Environmental Humanities in the School of English at the University of Kent. He wrote about chairs for The Conversation, and you can join in as well, 800-642-1234. How do you think chairs have changed you? Do you work in a desk job? Do you find yourself telling work colleagues, I'm tied to my desk or tied to my chair? Do you see the chair having prestige now like it did in history? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Baibar, I'm standing right now. I've ditched my chair, and that's a new thing we can now do in the studio where we can actually stand instead of sit in our studios. So are we seeing more of this as we see how we've learned in recent public health that sitting is bad for us?
Yeah, I mean, sitting is bad for us in lots of ways. And chairs, like so many things in our environment, chairs are changing our bodies. So standing for some, lower back pain, non-specific low back pain, which is the number one cause of global disability, back pain is strongly associated with chair use. So many people are switching to standing desks. But it really depends on what kind of back pain it is that you have. And, you know, just switching to a standing desk could worsen your back pain if that's something that you struggle with already. But it seems that standing desks make us more mentally active. One of the ways that seats or chairs are changing our bodies is that our feet are getting weaker because they spend a lot less time being loaded by our body weight. And if you're at a standing desk, that means that your feet are being used. So it's very good. They have many, many benefits, and I think we're going to see more and more of them. I also wonder whether the treadmill desk is going to become increasingly popular as well.
Have the design of chairs stayed pretty similar through the ages, or has the chair evolved in its design?
The chair has definitely evolved in its design. There's a wonderful, beautiful chair that I have at home called an Aaron chair, designed by Herman Miller. Once you've seen one of these and you know what it is, you'll see them. You see them in movies and all kinds of places. But they've sold, I think they've sold over 7 million of those chairs. So chairs are, and these are very optimized for to be comfortable to a whole range of different people of different body shapes and of different weights. But on the whole, the Klismos chair, which is a Greek chair from about 500 BC, beautiful thing, four legs, a seat and a back. It's not changed all that much. So in some ways, with the Aeron chair, that they've become more optimized, but the chair hasn't changed a great deal. And in fact, an uncomfortable chair from about 3,000 years ago would probably be better for our health than a really, really comfy, sofa that you can sit back in.
Oh, yeah, and it would be an antique and it would be sought after by the highfalutin fashion people, interior designers, to have in some home, right?
It would, and you'd consider it too precious to sit on. That's good as well.
Do you think we're more aware of the challenges or confusion that we're causing for our bodies? Because in some countries, people are not sitting. There might be squatting on floors, or they prefer a cross-legged position on the earth. How do our bodies adapt to all of this?
Okay, so certainly in lots of parts of the world, people are still squatting, and squatting, it seems, is much better for the human body. In fact, it looks like aspects of the human body are specifically designed for squatting. So lots of people in Southeast Asia, for example, would squat. People in India, not the younger generation, but the older generation, might sit cross-legged on a floor. And these all have different effects and different impacts on our body because they load the body weight at different hinges, like the lower back or the fronts of the knees. So it does make a difference. The nice thing about a standing desk is that it makes you more active. I don't know if you've noticed, Kate, but when you use a standing desk, you're much freer to move away from it to go and do something, rather, whereas you're in a chair, there's that little bit of friction that prevents you from getting up. You think, no, I'll do that when I'm up. So I do, yeah, people, different habits throughout the world are having different effects on the body, yes.
And we spend so much of our lives indoors now, which is something that you addressed in another recent essay you wrote for the website, The Conversation, especially when it comes to children and their health. What does research tell us about the effects of that?
Okay, so the research is from my book, Climate Change. But so indoor life really begins about 10 to 20,000 years ago when we start to gather in these early settlements. Excuse me. Once we gather, get a few branches of oak and make them into a simple dome so that we have some shelter while our crops grow. This behavior has now become so complete in modern life that in certain places like, especially in Southeast Asia or in Singapore, because so much of children's time is spent indoors, it means that normal eye development is disrupted because a child's eye needs access to very good quality light so that it knows when to stop growing. And if it continues to grow, it's trying to make a best guess at the optimal shape that its eyeballs should be. And what happens is you get short-sightedness. So there are some genes that are involved in driving short-sightedness, but it's overwhelmingly driven by an indoor environment and habits that are associated with being indoors, like screen time, TV time, and reading. But it's not those activities themselves. It's most likely the fact that these things tend to be done in lower quality light. So you now have a country like Singapore, you have 85% of people that are short-sighted. In South Korea's capital, in Seoul, 96.7% of 19-year-old men are short-sighted. And it's happening in the US, it's also happening in the UK. The younger generations who are driven to school, who spend about 8 or 9 hours in school, then they have after school clubs, then they have tutors, then they have music lessons, then they have homework, and by that time all they want to do is play a little bit of Fortnite or play Unknown Battlegrounds. And in the UK last year, a survey was done by Public Health England, and they found that most children in the UK spend less time outdoors than prison inmates.
Wow. So given your look at how the changes we've made are changing us, what advice would you leave us with today?
You need to introduce friction into your life, because the main thing that technology does is it takes away our opportunities to move. It saves us time, but it takes away our opportunities to move. So in the 1940s, to clean a rug, people would take it into their backyard and they would whack it with a stick for 20 minutes. So the cleaning of a rug would burn about 200 to 300 calories. Now all we do is bend over and activate the switch on the robot vacuum, and that burns about 0.2 calories. So that's a movement drop of about 1,000%. And if you think like all aspects of our lives, actually not all, but many aspects of our lives silently take away these opportunities for movement, and we don't see them. We think it's natural and it's normal. So it's a good idea to try to introduce some friction into your life. Try to do a few more things manually. Walking a bit further is a very big thing. When I was researching my book, I found the research so alarming, I ended up filling my house with houseplants, and I also got rid of my car. I'm nearly 50. I never not had a car. And after all I'd learned about what they do to our bodies, what they do to our lungs, I just thought I couldn't possibly continue. So I've now been for a year and a half without a car, which is quite tricky. But it means I walk about 6 miles, 7 miles a day. And it feels normal to me. It's a part of my working life. It's a normal habit for me. So I would say, try to introduce some friction into your life that will allow you to move a little bit more than you do.
And very quickly, as we wrap up and circling back to the chair, do you see the chair holding a high importance in our society going forward?
I think it will, because it's that I think that symbol will continue. But I think that in 10, 20 or 30 years time, we aren't going to see 60 billion chairs on the planet.
Well, Vibar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Vibar Cregan-Reed is a reader in English and Environmental Humanities in the School of English at the University of Kent. His most recent book is Primate Change: How the World We Made is Remaking Us. Coming up this year brought forth a slew of new, critically acclaimed, noteworthy TV shows. Before we anticipate what 2019 will offer, we look at the most innovative and creative shows of 2018. What do you think was the biggest TV show of the year? What did you binge on? Go ahead, tell us, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's a strong year for television, however you desire to consume it these days. This is the time of year when TV critics round up their lists of the best shows of the year. And we give a ring to Robert Thompson. He's a professor of television pop culture and director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. He's been dubbed a pop culture ambassador by the Associated Press. Robert, Ambassador, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you. I'm not sure that's an official title.
I like it. We'll stick with it. So you don't stand a chance in watching everything out there. I read some statistic that there were 480-some scripted shows in 2017. I couldn't find a figure for 2018. You're toast.
Yeah, it's a little bit over 500. It's beginning to level off a little bit in its growth. But I think it's going to get worse again, because we've got all these new streaming services that are poised to start up in 2019, as a matter of fact.
Well, I was reading some critic this morning, critic at large for Vox, who said the sheer glut of programming has made just about everything a little bit worse. There are way more good shows than ever before, but almost all of them are just good enough. So, I mean, it sounded a little bit cranky, but what do you think of that?
Yeah, well, I don't know that I would. Quantity does not, if the same person was making all of this stuff, obviously the quality of it would suffer. But we've got more good programming on than we've ever had before. We've got more bad programming on than we ever have before. And every now and again, we've got more really, really, really good programming on. So I'm not sure that the number of scripted programming is somehow diluting the quality of any individual show necessarily. It is, however, diluting our ability to watch it. I mean, there are a lot of really good shows that I need to keep up with, but I'll watch the first four episodes instead of all eight of each season.
Yeah, you're like kind of like a wine taster, right? You'll sample one and move to the next.
Exactly. The only difference is you don't get hammered watching TV. You just get sleepy.
Well, let's start by talking about the new TV you saw in 2018. What are the most impressive new shows in your opinion?
Well, I've been saying this now ever since it started its first season, but Atlanta, I think, is the best new show to come out in a long time. Its second season was really extraordinary, and I would put that on the top of my list. By the way, this was the year of Donald Glover. In May, he hosted Saturday Night Live. Atlanta season two was just as good, if not better, than season one. As Childish Gambino, he released This Is America, that extraordinary video. He was Lando Calrissian in a Star Wars movie, Solo. Mm. And in 2019, he'll be the voice of none other than Simba.
He's
in his zone in his career.
Well, help us with Atlanta. You know, some people describe it about being the American experience, about identities, figuring out what it means to be an individual in a world, intent on putting people in their places. How do you describe Atlanta?
Well, it does all of that. I mean, it's a very contemporary American story. But the way it does it is really interesting in that you never know when you tune in an episode of Atlanta what you're going to see. In the first season, they did an entire episode that was a talk show, the kind you'd see on BET, complete with commercials that they made up. And if you dialed the 800 numbers on the commercial, you'd actually get connected to them. So the entire thing was completely done in that style. They did it one this season, which was a horror story. It took place in this kind of weird haunted house sort of thing. They did a beautiful flashback episode where the two main characters only appear as children this season. So it's almost as though every single episode of this is kind of an independent little 30-minute film, but that is gradually putting together this story of all of those important American issues that you talked about.
And it's built on this sitcom structure, so they can morph. They can do a baroque horror film one week and then be a very silly comedy the next.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, of course, in fiction, you could do anything you wanted, but for so many decades in the history of American television, we knew what a 30-minute comedy was like. It always looked pretty much the same. It didn't matter really what it was about. There were these standards, and the same was true of an hour-long drama. That messing with those generic constraints began in the 1980s. Shows like Moonlighting. Was it a comedy? Was it a drama? Nobody quite knew. They did an animated or a claymation episode. They did an episode in black and white. And now that whole beginning to break those rules that started in the 1980s, we're now seeing more and more people do. Even a series like American Horror Story, which has many of the same actors for each season, but they're playing different parts. It's a completely different setting, a different premise. And that is turning out to be some of the most interesting new television to come along in a while.
Robert Thompson is with us. He's a professor of television and pop culture. We're working through the best TV shows that he saw in 2018 and getting your thoughts on the best TV as well at 800-642-1234. What piqued your interest? What did you binge on? What did you keep going back to? What surprised you? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So let's move on because we have like 500 and some to get through here. So in Barry, move to Barry here. Bill Hader plays a hitman.
Oh, that's on my list too, yeah.
An aspiring actor, like an assassin with a heart of gold, someone wrote about him, an unusual set of circumstances. Let's hear a bit from that series.
Money's good. It's a job. Yep.
Hey, ma'am. Are you seeing this beautiful morning? What are you doing?
How are you?
What am I doing? I'm set up here like you asked me to.
Oh, right. Duh.
The acting class made me feel really good. I feel really motivated right now. These are professional actors. They're the real deal, and they say I got something.
All right, so acting, moonlighting as a hitman. What's going on here?
Well, for one thing, it is a great, and you got a little bit of it in that clip. You've got this guy who, for whatever reasons, has ended up as a hitman, arguably one of the most evil professions one can imagine. And then, like all kinds of other humans, he gets a little bit of experience acting to a small audience of just his class, and he gets bitten by the bug. Suddenly he wants to be a thespian. And that's a really interesting premise. And throw in Henry Winkler, who got an Emmy for it, by the way. I think his first Emmy he ever got. And it is one of the most delightfully creepy shows to come along in a while. And it's got an ending that is really something.
You're going to leave us hanging there. So is it a comedy? Is it a thriller? Is it a bit of both? How can we compartmentalize it?
Yeah, as we were talking about with Atlanta, you can't. I mean, it's it has comic elements. There are certainly laugh-out-loud funny moments to it. But, of course, there's no laugh track. It's also very dark. This guy is, after all, a hitman. People die in this show. So it's a, I guess, dark comedy. comedy is what people normally label these things at. But we've got more and more of those kinds of shows out there. Another great show, by the way, in the same acting vein, The Kominsky Method, that just debuted on Netflix not too long ago.
Alan Arkin and Michael Douglas.
Right.
Yeah. So well, what's noteworthy
pairing,
about that?
There. And that's also a really interesting show, which also it's kind of Barry without the assassinations.
Well, it's funny, you know, I guess in Hollywood you would say write what you know about. So it seems like this motif of being an actor is kind of getting some play this season. Let's hear a little bit from The Kominsky Method.
You know, I wake up every morning. My first thought is, what part of me is not working today?
Yeah, we are passengers on boats slowly sinking.
Your boat is slow? I'm like when the Titanic was pointing up. So how's your love life? You're still seeing, what's her name, Triscuit?
Tristan. And no.
Oh, that's too bad. She was kind of cute.
Well, we didn't have much to talk about. You know, she was half my age.
Half your age is still an old woman.
It sounds like they're having a blast in playing these roles about old age. And Michael Douglas is up there. He's 74. So this seems to be pretty, you know, kind of fun for him.
Yeah, it looks like they are, as you say, having a blast doing this as actors. And also, as that clip reveals, this is about acting, but it really is about getting old. As so many of the late Philip Roth, who passed this year as well, later novels, they were about aging. In many ways, you know, getting old is a type of acting. It is a role that you more and more need to play. And the first role you've got to play is, I've got to get up in the morning.
And there's some snappy dialogue in this. The show's creator, Chuck Lorre of Big Bang Theory fame. Does that make sense?
Yes. Now, that I'm glad you brought that up because, of course, this guy is, since we started this conversation, he's probably gotten $1 billion worth of royalties delivered in wheelbarrows full of cash to his house. He did The Big Bang Theory, which is going to end this coming year. He did Two and a Half Men. He did Mom, a very, very popular, good old-fashioned three-camera sitcoms with an audience laughing in the background. This is a very, very different kind of program. I think if I wouldn't have known going into this that this was a Chuck Lorre production, I certainly don't think it would have occurred to me that it was. By far, I think the best work he has ever done.
Talking about the best television had to offer in 2018, what's on your list? 800-642-1234. Talking there, The Big Bang Theory is ending after 12 seasons on CBS. Talking with Robert Thompson, a television and pop culture professor at Syracuse. You have a line at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to the conversation, maybe hear from you in a minute here on the Ideas Network. Morning show. I'm Kate Archer Ken, talking best TV of 2018. American Crime Story was back this year for its second season, this time telling the true crime story of the murder of famous Italian fashion designer Gianni Versace by the serial killer Andrew Cunanan. According to FBI records, on July 15, 1997, Cunanan opened fire at point blank range, shooting Versace twice in the back of the head.
Shortly before 9 a.m., fashion designer Gianni Versace was shot on the steps of his villa.
Pronounced Versace.
Singer?
That's Liberace.
He was a creator. He was a genius. Everything you see around us, this house, this company, was his life. I will not allow that man, that nobody, to kill my brother twice.
Cunanan is played by Glee star Darren Criss. The show is leading TV in the 2019 Golden Globe nominations, by the way, four nods. Robert Thompson is taking it all in, talking us through the year in TV. You can join in as well at 800-642-1234. What were the standout performances for you this year in TV? Maybe you really admired the directing or cinematography of a particular show. Tell us about it. Did you like a particular show this year? And maybe you want Robert to give you a recommendation recommendation based on what you liked. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Robert, American Crime Story, unique series, features a different story each season. What did you think about season two?
Well, the season one was such a masterpiece. That was the O.J. Simpson season. And I thought I knew pretty much everything about that O.J. Simpson. I had watched it while it was going on. But I learned so much from that. I got so many insights and my consciousness raised. So that first season was really, really some of the best television really ever made. This was not quite that sophisticated, but it's sure getting a lot of critical acclaim. So it's everybody doesn't agree with me. It kind of struck me as one of these, again, stories that may take a little too long to be told. Darren Criss, of course, was really, really deliciously creepy as Andrew Cunanan. So it was a fine show. I'm not sure I'm quite as excited about it as most other people seem to be, however.
He said, Darren Criss said he's done after playing Cunanan and he will never play a gay character again. What about an actor forming a deep bond with the character only if they have, you know, shared experiences? What about straight actors playing gay characters?
Well, that's a big debate now. It's moving ahead forward. You know that Amazon show Transparent?
Mm-hmm.
That's the star of that is in fact not a trans actor. My guess is that if that show would have been made a mere 2 years after, if it had been started a mere 2 years after it was, that they probably would have gotten a trans actor to do that. I think there's much more of a consciousness about that now. But after all, acting is acting. You portray people, you become people that are different than you, that aren't you. But there are limits to that now. I think if you were now to cast a white person as an Asian or an African American or whatever, you would certainly hear about it, and for good reason.
Well, let's move on to Pose. The show on FX, set in the 80s, features drag queen club culture. What did you think about the artistic qualities of Pose?
Oh, I like Pose a lot. This is, again, getting a lot of attention, a lot of nominations, including, I think, Golden Globe for Best Television Series in Drama. Very stylized, very, lush in its 80s kind of look of this ball culture and all the rest of it. I highly recommend this show. And it's an FX program, I think you said.
Someone said it offers a more universal story about a group of rejected, shunned people who build new families for themselves, replacing the blood relatives who so often let them down. Does this...
Yeah, you could have said that about the Mary Tyler Moore show, but... No, you're right. It does all that. And this is something that we see a lot of in television series, is that so much of TV in the early years were about biological nuclear families. Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, The Donna Reed Show, Ozzie and Harriet, on and on and on and on and on. When we moved into the 1970s, we started to replace that nuclear family with, in fact, either workplace families or ad hoc families. And you're right, from The Big Bang Theory to Pose, these are about people whose identities are determined by the culture they surround themselves with, not by the people they grew up with.
Let's also look at TV in relation to what was happening in our society. We saw Roseanne Barr's show get canceled because of her racist tweet. And then there was the Me Too movement. Within the last year, women frequently speaking up about harassment they faced in and out of the workplace, in the TV industry. How has that impacted TV?
Yeah, these, I think, are the two biggest TV stories of 2018. First of all, Roseanne comes in the spring and knocks everybody else out of the park in terms of ratings, a huge hit of the kind we don't see too much anymore. Then she does these tweets, and the show gets canceled, and no sooner do we take a breath, but it's back again as the Connors, not doing quite as well as Roseanne had debuted at, but getting about the same ratings as the last episode of Roseanne before it was canceled had. So that was a big story, and we can tie that in with others. Megyn Kelly, her comments on blackface got her knocked off of NBC. Kevin Hart isn't hosting the Oscars. So that story continues to continues, and I think Roseanne is the big one of it. And then with Me Too, we saw some of these things begin to now take their course. The Les Moonves story is probably the biggest here, where this guy, who was arguably, as head of CBS, one of the most powerful arbiters of popular culture on planet Earth, turns out to have all of these skeletons in his closet. He was, of course, fired, and they did the internal investigation, and they're not going to give him his $120 million severance package, and he becomes another sort of representation of this big, big problem. Not to mention Cosby was sentenced in 2018.
Well, Colbert has been pretty frank about his feelings and critiques of Moonves. Has the network's programming suffered in any way?
You know, as much as important as Les Moonves was to that network, and he was there for a long time, CBS is going to do just fine without Moonves. Certainly some of his relationships and contacts and all the rest of it were valuable to that network, but no, I don't see suddenly in the post-Moonves era everything falling apart at CBS. Of course, we wouldn't notice that because it takes a while for programs to get developed and everything, but I think CBS will do just fine without Les Moonves.
So here we are about a week and a half away from the Golden Globes Awards, which celebrates some of the best TV and films of the year. Which TV shows do you expect to win big this year?
Well, far be it for me to make predictions. All I'll say is that when you look at the lists of the nominations for all these awards, Golden Globes, Emmys, and all the rest of it, there is just so much good television out there. I mean, every single one of those things on the list of best comedy and best drama are really good. I would have never guessed when I was a kid watching The Flying Nun and Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie that television would ever look like this when I grew up.
So are you anticipating a big 2019 for TV? You said we were kind of leveling off, perhaps, with scripts this year, but you'll see more scripted TV next year?
Yeah, well, this could be the year that the streaming wars really happen. Four new big streaming entities are due to launch in 2019. Warner Media, who, of course, has got Friends, Big Bang Theory, Harry Potter, Game of Thrones. They just sold 1 year of rights to Friends to Netflix for $100 million. So Warner Media is launching. Disney, of course, is finally launching their big thing. Walmart, which has already been going but is going to be kind of relaunched again, and Apple. And all four of those plan to do, you know, the usual library of stuff, but all four are also doing and have got in the hopper original programming. So by the time we get to 2020, you may need to be paying Amazon, Hulu, Netflix, Warner, Disney, Apple, and Walmart for if you want to watch all the shows.
Well, Robert, so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Robert Thompson is a professor of television and pop culture, directs the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.